Okay. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report a man who needs no introduction. Franklin Sanders is here in his capacity, Reverend Franklin Sanders is here in his capacity as the leader of Christ Our Hope Church. And we're going to talk about the jailhouse ministry that Franklin leads for the church and the congregation. So, Franklin, welcome back to the Solari Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Glad to be here.
So explain how this got going. Every week, I should just say before you start, I get a wonderful report on email about what the ministry has done each week in the local county jail. And so I feel like I have watched the evolution of this, but maybe if you could just start and talk about what inspired you to do this and what's happened, how it's evolved, where you are today.
Well, I was fortunate enough to get sent to jail back in the 1990s when I was fighting with the federal government about, and actually the state government too, because the federal government was after me for income tax. What they said was, well, I'd started a gold and silver bank, and they said that was a scheme to evade taxes, which it never was. But anyway, they indicted a whole bunch of us. And in the course of doing that, they did what...
Can I just interrupt and say one thing?
Sure.
A tremendous effort was made to try and falsify and frame me into prison.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many people who told... And I was told, you're going to jail. There's nothing you can do. It's hopeless. It's been rigged. There's nothing you can do. So it cost me $6 million in 11 years and more than many miracles to stay out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're listening to Franklin talk about how he got railroaded into jail, I can tell you it happens all the time, and it's much easier than you think.
Oh, yeah, I guarantee it is. So anyway, one of the things that the feds do often is they double team. Or they do what I call double teaming. That is, they cook up some state charge against the people they've identified as their enemies, and then they go after them with that charge, too. And what that means is that you just have too much to defend yourself against. And if that sounds like an exaggeration, that's because your listeners have never tried to defend themselves against a criminal charge before.
They might not have $6 million.
Right. I mean, it's just amazing how much money it runs through how fast. So in any event, on this state charge that they brought against me, which was also preposterous, I got convicted. And so I went to the penal farm in Memphis. Now, Memphis, you've got to remember, is probably over a million people in the metropolitan area, and they have this penal farm. They used to have a penal farm, and this is the way things once upon a time were done, that the county had what they called a penal farm, and it was a self-supporting unit. That is, that the misdemeanors, people who were in jail for a short time, less than a year, that's 11 days, 11 months, 29 days, would go there and they would have to work for a living. In other words, they had a farm there, and they raised cash crops, they raised their own food, they raised their own meat, milk, all that sort of stuff. So it was really a profit center, so to speak. It really didn't, they didn't try to make money at it, but it supported itself. Well, over the years, misguided philanthropy and government greed have destroyed that kind of system, which you may think is cruel to be forced to work, but that's what the Constitution says, is that you're when you're convicted of a crime, you're made a slave and you have to do whatever they say. And that may sound cruel, but it can't even hold a candle to the cruelty of locking someone up in a cell where he can barely move and just holding him there and letting him out three times a day, 15 minutes to get food, and then maybe an hour of exercise. And that's what the whole system has gone to. It's gone away from those things where you have work to do, from those institutions where you have work to do that makes the time pass quickly, into these institutions where the only thing to do is to play cards or dominoes and watch TV. and you never get out. Most of these jails now being built, the county jails, and your listeners ought to look around themselves and they'll realize, hey, we got a new jail in this county. And then you go to the next county and you see the same thing is going on. And the reason is because they're profit centers. It's been made into an industry. And these new jails that are being built, they don't get any daylight at all. And you can just, you know, kind of let your mind run crazy about what that does to you when you get a vitamin D deficiency and the implications for depression. But
one thing I'll say is when you drive across Tennessee, what I've seen is huge criminal justice centers and huge, jail facilities. And often, you know, certainly in my county, it was terribly controversial because many of us felt we couldn't afford it. These things are very, very expensive and oftentimes paid with issuance of new bonds. You know, so there's a bond business, there's a construction business, but the maintenance of these facilities, you know, the problem that the local sheriffs have is they're so busy, trying to staff these big facilities and, you know, process foreclosures that they don't have time to do the basic, you know, protecting the citizenry. So there's a real tension.
There is, but there's also this pull that, oh, the county's going to make money this way. And not only that, all the people involved in the industry are going to make money. And it's
right.
A jobs program because you're going to need guards on an ongoing basis, and you've got to have them 24 hours a day. And somebody's going to make money for floating the bonds, and somebody's going to make money doing the construction. I came across the figure, $5.1 billion a year spent on prison construction.
Well,
incredible, but it's true.
In 1996, when I was working on a plan to create data, well, we had started a data servicing business that was doing data servicing in low-income communities. And one of the things we priced out was what was the benefit to the federal budget of having people have jobs that they could do locally. You had a whole group of people, particularly women, who because of child care and parent care couldn't commute long distances, but could do very sophisticated data servicing work, you know, if they had a place to work nearby. And so our question was, how much money could you save? And one of the things we priced out, you know, what's the cost of various people going to prison? Because one of the things we discovered was, you know, $10 per hour plus health care buys almost everybody off of dealing drugs. And an analysis came out from the General Accounting Office at the time that if you looked at 100% of the costs of running the system of the prisons, and so that included all the servicing and probation and everything else, they were spending $154,000 per prisoner, federal, state, and local combined. So each prisoner costs $154,000 per year. Now, that includes the construction costs as well, I'm assuming, from looking at the GAO study. But it's much more expensive per person than everybody thinks. And, of course, that's a very rich job program, and it's a very rich construction and professional fee flow.
Right. And then, there are going to be some counties where money's going to pass under the table to get the contracts involved.
Right.
And so there are ample opportunities for graft. And let me hasten to add, I'm not complaining about the local jail that we work with. The personnel are just amazing.
Right. They're wonderful people in the system. That's what always amazes me. A lot of my neighbors here in Tennessee work in the local jail. You know, we have three privatized prisons, and they're wonderful people.
Yeah. And but it's the system, as I – The system takes people who are the least able in society to protect themselves. And I'm not saying they're all good people. Don't misunderstand me. A lot of them are really mean people. And, and really, you know, they're the dregs of society for a reason. They make themselves the dregs of society. But that you've created a system where you've made an industry out of putting human beings into one end of a meat grinder and grinding them up, and out the other end of the meat grinder comes money for a whole lot of people except them and ground up human beings. And there are people who are so institutionalized that almost impossible to imagine how they would ever function outside of society. But let me go back and pick up my history again.
Okay.
So when I was in jail, I met people. Now, you have to imagine, in Memphis, the penal farm was built in the 1920s for about 1,200 people, and there were about 2,400 people there. And I was like the great white defendant, you know, because Memphis is about 50% black, and the incarceration rates in the United States are very much balanced, very much overbalanced with blacks and Hispanics. In other words, you're very likely to go to jail between the time you're 20 and 30 if you're black, as opposed to being white. And in any event, I met a lot of people in the jail who'd been in there, you know, 3 years, sitting there, nothing to do, reading their Bibles. You know, people who had memorized large passages, you know, large swaths of the scripture. And then they'd get out, and 2 weeks later, they'd be right back in there. They'd be right back doing what they'd done before. And I'd go to these jail services, and what it was, you know, these churches would come in, and they were doing their quote, ministry for the week, you know, and they didn't ever mingle with the prisoners or anything. They're up on the stage, and they come in, and they sing for a while and get everybody all excited, and then the preacher gets up and tells everybody to do better so you won't ever have to come back here again. And I'm thinking to myself, well, hey, if they could do better, would they have landed in here in the first place? What are you speaking about? So anyhow, I don't know, Catherine, it just breaks your heart when you see these people on this treadmill, this squirrel cage, and they can't get off. But I did see some people who got out, just like there's some people who get out of drug addiction and some people who get out of alcoholism. The estimated rates from AA are that about 1 in 4 alcoholics who goes to AA actually gets out from under alcohol. And I don't know what it's like with narcotics, but I'm sure it's, you know, about the same. So it's the numbers are not encouraging. And the conclusion I came to was that only God can get people out of that. And, you know, whether your listeners understand and believe that or not, I can't help it. I've seen so much that I think there are very, very few human beings, if any, who have the resolve that they can tighten up the belt of their will and get out of it that themselves.
Well, I would say it this way. It's the only place you can go to get more power than what you're up against.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good way to put it.
Right.
And so we had, I moved over here, you know, all that was behind me, although I went back into the jail in Memphis. And so in Easter of 2010, one of the men in our parish was in jail. He was going to be there over the Easter weekend. And so I just couldn't stand the thought of him being in there without being able to celebrate communion over Easter. So I went to the jail administrator and I said, do you have any nights open? Thinking, you know, every night would be, every Sunday night would of course be taken. I said, do you have any night open, any Sunday open that we could do a worship service? Or I said, first, can I come in and do a worship service? She said, well, yeah, sure. I said, well, do you have any Sunday nights open? She said, yeah, all of them. I said, I'll take them.
Yeah, that sounds like the Franklin Sanders I know.
I really didn't think
of course,
you hadn't
talked to anybody at the church.
No, I hadn't talked to anybody. And I hadn't really thought about what I was doing and how I was going to do this. But in any event, now I was on the hook for every Sunday of the month. And so, you know, we go in and we use a Book of Common Prayer service, the liturgy or Eucharist. And it's a 500-year-old service. And people would tell me, "Oh, you can't do that in jail. They'll never get that." And it's not—it's really not even as stilted as King James English. It's quite understandable, really. But here's the point: we went in there, and all of these inmates, they said, "Oh, they can't understand that." They participate more enthusiastically and just as well as the people in my parish did. I mean, they're right there. It took them a few weeks to catch on, but they've caught on, and they understand the message of hope and the love of God that comes through the liturgy, and they hear it, and it affects them. They hear it, and it affects them, and I think it changes them. But the problem is, of course, you know, we don't have a lot of time to work with them individually. Here's the problem. I go in about 6 o'clock, and it takes about 45 minutes to do a service, and we've done as many as 6 services in a night. Sometimes get out of there at 11 o'clock. And I'm glad to do those services. We have probably, we'll do services for about 50 men a night, but it's in, you know, they're broken up, not more than 20 in a night. And the circumstances are not great. It's a classroom that they've got. Sometimes we have to use what they call the recreation room, which is a 2-story tall room about the size of a basketball court, and the echoes are just phenomenal. The thing is that these men are hungry to hear what we've got to say, and the women are too. Now, we don't get to go into the women's side, which we've been trying to do, and we've only been in a few times, but the response is just enormous. And this is not, I don't want you to think that this is some kind of watered-down thing that we do. We confront these people with their own lifestyle and their lives and how they got there. And by confront, I mean the service confronts us all with our sin, but the sermon, I mean, there's always a sermon there, and I don't, you can't play games with people like this. Look, we're in jail, okay? I mean, in a sense, they're easier to deal with than other people.
Yeah, they speak outside, English. They don't talk pretzel talk.
Yeah, they don't. You know, they're not pretending they're okay. Come on, I'm sitting here in jail. I'm not. You know, no, my life is not okay. My life is in rags. And,
let me ask you a couple things about the prisoners you're dealing with. How many of them are Caucasian?
Almost all of them.
Right. So you're dealing, you're not dealing with the African-American and Hispanic crowd. You're dealing with an all. You know, this is a very different picture than I think most people have a picture, you know, that this is a very racial phenomenon. They don't begin to see how the model is eating its way through the poor Caucasian population.
Oh yeah, no, it's the there are all the same problems here that there were in Memphis. It's just they're white when they go to jail rather than being black.
Now, how many of them are in jail for drug related offenses, whether dealing drugs or taking drugs?
Catherine,
you know?
There wouldn't be any jails if there weren't for the war on drugs. Well, you wouldn't need them. I mean, you could have one jail in the country. At least 75, maybe 85% of the people are there for either alcohol or drug-related offenses. And when I say alcohol or drug-related, I mean they were doing drugs or drunk when they committed a crime, or they're there for dealing in drugs. And most of them who do drugs deal in drugs as well.
Now, in my experience, most of the people dealing drugs don't have an economic culture. In other words, they go into it because it makes money. It's a business.
Right.
It's a job.
Yeah, and it supports their habit.
Right.
There is a level of drug dealer who knows not to use drugs, but these are not those people. These are the ones who are hooked and looking for a way to do it. And they're not really all hooked either. They just don't want to do anything else. And you're talking already. See, in the black population, I was jailed with people who had not had a man in the family or what we would think of as a, you know, regular family with a husband and wife, you know, mother and father and siblings in maybe 4 generations.
Right.
And these over here, probably some of them are in their second generation.
Right.
Without a, you know, where they come from a broken home. By broken, I mean that they never lived together with their mother and father till they grew up.
And see, what I've found in all these circumstances is a person can't get out of this without developing good habits.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole experience they've been in their entire lives, or, you know, certainly once they got in the machinery, it breaks down, it breaks a person down, and what it does is it destroys their habits. And getting them to the point where they can form good habits that will make them productive in life is, you know, is the biggest challenge in the world. And I would say it's not possible, it's hopeless, except, you know, one of my favorite sermons, the preacher says, you know, how can you not have, my God can do anything. And I have seen people literally who I would have bet you any amount of money were completely hopeless, you know, get into church and get into a process, and a year later they're wearing a three-piece suit and holding down a job. And I can't believe it's the same person. it's absolutely possible.
You're kind of jumping ahead to something I was going to say later, but I'll go on and talk to it now. You know, I stand there and tell them, look, here are Franklin's four rules for never coming back to jail. And there's probably not a one of you in here who can follow these four rules. The four rules are easy. Number one, don't go around your old friends. Number two, don't do drugs or alcohol. Number three, obey all the laws. And number four, get into a church and go every time the doors are open. And the reason for that last one is to change those habits.
Right.
Because, see, they go back around their old friends and immediately they fall back into those old habits of, you know, hanging out, doing a little dope, you know, drinking beer, and then basically they have nothing to do, so they get into trouble.
Right.
And one of the things that's one of the things that's really been impressed on my mind is what these people need is an atmosphere where they can, a place where they can go for about a year and learn to govern themselves. This is one of the things we tell them over and over and encourage them to help each other. They have to learn to govern themselves. They have to learn they can make their own choices and rule their own lives and their own emotions. And they really, I think the best setting for doing that, is to have a farm where they can work, where they can see that their own hands can do something, that they're capable of working, and where they're put under a discipline of working. And I think there ought to be, you know, a religious discipline in that too. And by the way, I have to tell you, I read about the Texas prison system. The Texas prison system is the largest in the country, and it's huge, and they raise all of their own fiber.
It can't be bigger than California. You must mean bigger on a per capita.
Well,
it can't be bigger than the California system.
Well, maybe it's not, but anyway, it's huge, and it's self-supporting. See, everybody there has to work. Everybody has to do something, which, as I said before, is not as cruel as locking them in a room and leaving them there.
Well, the other thing is they learn skills.
That's exactly right. Well, so they started something that nobody else in the country does, and that is they have these what they call Christian dorms. And the people who, the inmates, in order to get in there, the inmate doesn't have to be a Christian, but he has to agree to follow their rules. And they have sort of, they're sort of self-governing in the sense that if somebody breaks those rules, they can vote him out, and he's out.
Wow, that's great.
Oh, well, here's what's interesting about it. The recidivism rate is 3 out of 4 in the general population. Coming out of these dorms, the recidivism rate is 1 out of 4. It's just exactly flipped. So that underscores what I'm saying about what we need is farms where these people can go and work for a year until they learn to govern themselves.
Right.
And because if they don't learn to govern themselves, then you're going to, you know, as soon as they go out, they're going to get right back into the same old
home. So let me just bring up a tough point here, and that is they have to learn to govern themselves. But we have an entire country of people, many of whom have never learned how to govern themselves in a world of real trouble. And that's what they're grappling with. Because I will tell you, the hardest thing to do is to keep up good habits when you're grappling with, you know, the enforcement buzzsaw coming towards you, or, you know, in the middle of the kind of trouble we're in. So, you know, the question of how the prisoners that you're working with develop good habits is not unrelated to how the rest of us keep them going.
Well, you know, one of the things that I never try to raise false hopes in these folks. And one of the things that the primary direction that we're trying to send them into is toward a life with God and toward depending on God instead of themselves. And that dependence has to be daily, because in the situation you just lined out, they're going to be trapped into some kind of false move immediately,
right?
Because they just don't have the strength to meet. They don't have the strength of will and character and soul to meet all of these challenges.
It's funny. One of my favorite gospel songs, one of the lines is, "He is my portion." In other words, my relationship with God is what I get. That's my reward. And I would be in all these situations where, you know, money was being taken away, possessions were being stolen, and I had to just keep saying that to myself again and again. You know, I have God, so I get my reward. That's what I get. You know, apparently this chair was never mine to begin with.
Well, you know, part of what we try to start doing with them is, Johnny Bain, who's the deacon in our church, and he goes in alternative weeks, the weeks I don't go in, he goes in.
And the way he does this and the way he reports about it and the way he speaks about it is so inspiring, so inspiring.
Well, anyway, he said, you know, the problem is we're treating these people like baby birds. All their lives they've been treated like baby birds. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, when the mother bird lands on the nest, all the little baby birds know to open their mouths and squeak to be fed.
Uh-huh.
And that's what these fellas have been trained to do through their whole lives, is to be passive, is to wait to be fed, wait to be told what to do. They're told by the justice system. They're told by this person or that person what to do. And when they're not told what to do, they just run wild, because they've never run any part of their own lives themselves.
Right. They don't know how to govern themselves. They don't know how to invent their world.
Right. And that, so part of what we do is we say, okay, while you're in here, you're going to start figuring out how to run your own life. While you're in here, you're going to start praying morning and evening and reading the scriptures. Just morning and evening. It's not like you've got a lot else to do anyway, but you start governing your life that way. And look around for the people that you can help in here, because there's somebody else you can help. And, you know, it's an amazing thing, Catherine. Nothing helps us like helping somebody else.
Oh, that's the truth.
it's unbelievable. And it's amazing what it draws out of these folks when they start doing that. And it's, you know, I've been amazed at the effort that I've seen out of some of them. And the changed countenance, that's a way I think. But do you know how when you see somebody and you perceive just from looking at them that there's a lot of trouble or a lot of illness, there's something about their countenance that just is not right. And, you can talk about vibes or auras or things like that. I'm not really talking about that. I'm just talking about the way they look. And you look at the person, you say, that poor person is sick. And I've seen a lot of them in jail that whose countenances have changed. Who now, and I think the reason their countenance changes is because they have hope. And there have been many who've been, I'm sure.
Right, but it's not just abstract hope. It's they can see a process which can take them from here to there.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the hope, they have a hope that they don't have to spend the rest of their lives this way. And so, anyway, we've seen that happen. There are a lot of disappointments, too, you know. I mean, we've actually baptized a whole bunch of people in there, and some of them have gotten out and some of them have not. Let me give you some examples, okay? A fella came up to me and he said, I'm 34 years old and I've been in prison in some kind of custody since I was 14. He's been in and out of custody since he was 14. And he's 34 years old. More than half of his life, he's been on that squirrel cage going round and round. Well, he got really serious and you know, he was working real hard while he was in there, and then he got out. Last night he showed up again after 7 months out, and another fellow showed back up too, who was actually even more promising. The thing that, you know, part of what you have to do working with these people is realize they're going to fall down two or three times.
Right. Right.
And you can't give up on them. You can't say, well, that's it. You've had your chance. You know, I'm going to move on to somebody else. Because maybe they will move up. Maybe they will get out of it. And some of them have problems that are so severe as far as drug addictions and so forth that they're not, they, you know, they just need way more help than I can give them, seeing them once a week. I heard about a fella at another jail in another county who, you know, he was one of these in-and-outers, you know, in the squirrel cage. And he was in jail 75 days, and 69 of those days he was taking dope.
Mm.
So how does the dope get into the jail? How does the contraband get in there?
It's part of the business.
How does that go on? Well, you know, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. You don't know how that happens, but it does happen.
I don't know exactly, but I know conceptually exactly how.
Oh, yeah, well, money changes hands sometimes. Yeah, well, that was, you know, they did that in Memphis, actually, when I was over there. They banned smoking. Well, you know, all these people didn't have anything to do but smoke.
Right.
So what that meant was the guards could now take a
bigger cut.
$3 package of cigarettes and sell each cigarette, each of the 20 cigarettes, for $4 a piece, or $5 a piece. So did they have an incentive to smuggle? You betcha they did. But
so,
that is a problem too. Now, where I am, violence is not a big problem. In some places it is. There are some places that I would really think twice about going into. I mean, there's some places you get killed.
Right.
But most of these people are not that.
Most of the war on drugs folks are not violent. Mm. You know, most of these are nonviolent crimes.
Right. The overwhelming majority are. And then let me kind of explain for your listeners what when I talk about the squirrel cage, here's what I mean. They go in and they're convicted of some crime, whatever it is. And then they release them, they spend some time, and then they release them on probation. And the probation has all of these conditions. You got to go to these meetings, you got to go to meetings with your probation officer, you got to get a job, you've got to get, you got to take drug tests, you know, impromptu, unannounced drug tests. The officer can come out and search your house, where you live, and so forth and so on. And if you breach any of those contracts, if you fail to come, breach any of those requirements, if you fail to come to a meeting, if you fail a drug test, if you don't get a job, then you can be revoked. Your probation is revoked, and they send you back to jail, and you go back to jail and sit there a while longer, and then they let you out again. And there are all kinds of catch-22s in this because, for instance, most people can't work in the United States unless you have a car. But a lot of these people get out of jail and they can't drive because they don't have a driver's license. So what are they going to do? Or they put them in jail for not paying child support. But while
you're running through a day-to-day gauntlet. I call it the 26-step process.
Yes.
And it's almost impossible to make it through the gauntlet and be as perfect as you're required to be.
Right. And
so it's easy to give up.
They get revoked. And then, you know, they don't want to keep them forever, so they send them back out, and they get revoked again. And they literally, it just never stops. One fellow who comes to our service regularly came up to me the other night. He said, listen, my 43rd birthday is coming up in 2 weeks, and since I was 19, I have spent all but 5 years in jail.
Mm.
So this is what you're dealing with. And see, here's why I say the rehabilitation does not work. The incarceration does not work. All of the programs that they've got supposedly that millions of dollars are spent on do not work to change these people, have not changed them yet. And so what we're doing is we've got this great big industry that creates jobs for guards, for probation people, for private prisons for the courts. It makes money for the bailiffs. It keeps the judge in business and so forth and so on, and lawyers. But it doesn't do anything for the people. Those people who are the who are being processed through this system are not improved, and they're punished more. And this crazy idea that so many conservatives have, and I'm maybe a lot of liberals too, that we can just raise the stiffness of this jail sentence and that'll teach them a lesson. It doesn't teach anybody a lesson. It just makes them sit in jail longer, waiting to get out so they can go back to doing the same thing. And
there's something else. For every person who's in prison, there are 10 taxpayers who are working their whole life to pay for the cost of that $154,000 per year.
Right.
So you're talking about, you know, something that from a taxpayer standpoint is insane.
Absolutely, and they think that these counties think they're going to make money holding state prisoners. You know, because the state pays them so much per diem. I just don't see how they can amortize their costs.
I want to just bring up one story because I want to get into local economies and what this means to local economies.
Mm-hmm.
I came over, as you know, I have a habit of getting speeding tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily they don't put you in prison yet for that. And I ended up getting a speeding ticket in a county near the one you're in, not the one you're ministering in. And the one thing about this county was you had a courthouse in the middle of town, as you do in many small towns. And there was still a respectable number of, you know, cute little restaurants and other businesses around the jailhouse, because the courthouse and the flow of people coming to court for, you know, to take their speeding ticket course, you know, you had a fair amount of flow.
Right.
And I came over to go to the courthouse on the, you know, the last trip. And the courthouse, I walked in and they said, oh, you don't come here anymore. You go to the Criminal Justice Center outside of town. So, Franklin, I walk in and I walk out of the courthouse and I realize all the restaurants have gone out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And half of the little stores have shut down. And I realized, wait a minute, they moved this and they have shut down half of the remaining jobs on this square.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, if you're trying to ruin the local economy of a place, I can't think of a better thing to do. Well, I drive out. I finally find the criminal justice system. It's outside of town. And the whole town was like a ghost. It was just like a ghost town. There was no people there. There were, you know, it was just empty. I get out to the Criminal Justice Center, and there are hundreds of cars. The whole town was out at the Criminal Justice Center. I walk in. There are over 100 people waiting to, you know, deal with their speeding or other moving violation ticket. And I realized I had passed the new jail as I went. And I realized, you know, all the poor people are in jail and going through this process as to whether or not they're going to go to jail. All the middle class people are out here dealing with speeding tickets. And, you know, did they have their insurance card tickets? And, you know, it's not going to take but 20 years until we're all, you know, in the jail line. And it was amazing because I saw those 100 people, most of them sitting there for more than an hour. Some of them sitting there, you know, I would think I was there for two and a half hours. And I realized, you know, this is like the Salem witch trials. Everybody's at the courthouse. Nobody's out plowing the field.
I'm sorry I'm laughing, but when you start calculating what the incredible loss of productivity is that's spent in all that, it's just astounding. You know,
it was mind-boggling. You literally had an entire economy focused on the Criminal Justice Center, the prison, and the enforcement, you know, the enforcement process. And I thought, you know, this, if you all of this can only work so long as you can, you know, the Fed can print money and the Treasury can continue with the help of the U.S. military to get everybody worldwide to keep buying more and more bonds. This all depends on the long-term bull bond market, but the long-term bond market, I don't know how much longer it's going to last, but it looks to me like it can't last that much longer.
Well, I don't, you know, I don't think about it so much in those terms as I think about it in the sort of nightmarish terms that the slavery that oozes out of those jails and prisons is sort of infectious, you know, and it tends to infect the community around it, and it tends to grow and grow and grow and pull more and more lives into itself.
Right.
And, this is what a police state looks like. The bad thing is that in the United States, we don't have the Nazi-type police state. We don't have the Soviet-type police state. We have a police state that makes money for somebody.
Well, but we have, I remember when I first tried to warn people about what was happening, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about how people on Park Avenue were getting their kitchens redone using prison equipment because it was the new fashion, and GQ had a layout on businessmen, you know, standing in front of bars with prisoners behind it wearing their, you know, it's like lawyers wearing their new suit. And there was this whole effort to make prison fashionable. And what you're looking at, it's basically the Nazi model. It's very clever the way it's done, but you're, you know, it's sort of free range is the only way I can describe it, where you are entrapping or putting people in a process where they're bound to fail. You're running an enforcement model where you know, things are more and more complicated, and it gets much easier to sort of entrap people. Now, that model is moving up through the socioeconomic, you know, range. It was developed in the sort of the urban poorest neighborhoods, the most minority. It's moving into the rural white populations. We're now going to watch it, you know, be applied to everybody who's got a tax haven account that, you know, they haven't been impeccable with their paperwork, et cetera. You know, it's sort of moving upscale. And once you launch, you know, in 2015, once you launch surveillance drones all over the country, you can imagine, you know, how many infractions we can all be found guilty of if that's what it takes to finance the local budgets, and on and on and on. So it's a friendly fascism model, all designed to, you know, prove that you made a mistake or you were in the wrong before we throw you into the slave labor camp.
Well, you know, to give you an idea of the volume that we're talking about, in the United States has the second highest incarceration rate in the world, 716, maybe more than that, people per 100,000 inhabitants. The only place with a higher incarceration rate is North Korea with 800. And, you know, we rank just ahead of Cuba with 510 and ahead of Rwanda. And then it very quickly drops down to, you know, below 250 per 100,000. So this is a huge industry. You know,
right.
Billions and billions of dollars a year, and you know, it's not, I don't think it's crazy for you or me to say that it's expanding, because it is expanding.
It's expanding.
It's a huge growth industry.
And it's basically taking the premise, because if you look at the marketing of these things,
mm-hmm.
It's making the premise that this is all acceptable. And it is acceptable to believe that people are expendable. In other words, you get everyone if the enforcement model hasn't eaten to your socioeconomic group, you just get everybody above that line to say, oh, well, those people are bad, or those people aren't hardworking, or those people are, you know, whatever. But you create a mental picture of them as being expendable.
Well,
because that's what we're saying. We're saying they're expendable.
Dehumanizing.
Right.
They become unhuman. They're non-persons, and so it really doesn't matter much what you do with them, because
right.
They're not worth anything anyway.
Right.
And of course, the greatest, the best antidote for that is to go and see them, go and talk to them,
right.
Find out if they're human or not still.
Right.
Because they are. So, but. You know, and I'd really encourage your there are a lot of things that your listeners can do to work with these folks or help with them. A lot of them get out, and there are programs that you can work with to help them get out. Or, you know, churches generally we all have a bad tendency to be inward looking and to look to our own needs. And there's nothing like just, you know, going to the jail and offering to help, offering to mentor people, because those folks that sit in jail have nothing to do, and a lot of them have zero job skills and zero knowledge. They work they can work on GEDs while they're there. That helps some. Again, I don't, you know, I mean, all those things are sort of collateral to the help that they really need, and the help that they really need is to get their souls straight and to get their souls back.
Right.
Because they're in a place they can't get out of.
So if I'm sitting somewhere, I'm listening to this, where do I go to find a mechanism to help? So I can go to my local churches and find which ones have ministry.
Right. You can do that. And you can, there's a group called Prison Fellowship. I don't work with them, so I've heard that they were very good. But another thing you can do is, if you've got local folks, there's always somebody local, kind of like the Salvation Army, but not the Salvation Army. And they help these fellows when they get out of jail. For instance, here they turn them out at midnight, and where are they going to go?
Right.
I got no money. I don't have a reservation at the hotel. You know, what am I going to do? And I think you just have to look for local programs like that. I mean, there's one here called God's Storehouse, and they help folks like that. The Salvation Army may have something to help them with. Your local church may have something to help them with. Or you can just go to the jail and say, look, I'd like to volunteer to see if I can do something for these fellas. Is there, you know, do they have GED classes I could teach, or is there something else I could do?
Right.
And all those things feed into helping them get out.
Right. The other thing is, we all, in our personal networks, we all have family, friends, or whatever, people who've gotten into trouble, or we know of somebody. So, you know, one thing you can do is always turn around and help somebody in your personal world that has gotten into trouble, and see if you can help in whatever way is feasible for you. Now, I've got to put you on the spot, because you know this has always been a dream of mine. What would it cost? You know, my God's a big God, Franklin. He can do anything. Just remember that. So what would it cost to put together a farm operation near the church in Tennessee that could start to help people screened out of your ministry to be farming?
Well, you know, if you had a place that could put up maybe 40 fellas, you'd need, say, 200 acres, and maybe you could do that for $250,000, and then you'd need probably $100,000 operating budget. So you could probably do the whole thing for less than $500,000, which is a lot less cost to keep in jail.
So let's say you had $500,000. How much would it cost per prisoner? You know, so let's say somebody or a group of people donated $500,000. How much would it then cost for one person to underwrite one person for a year coming to learn how to be a farmer?
Oh.
Just a guess. We won't hold
you
to
it. I don't believe it costs more than $20,000, because you're going to be, you know, they're going to be growing their own food.
Right.
And so there's not, you know, once you get, there's a certain economy of scale, and so that part of the operating cost, once you get it up and running, is not going to be so great, but you're going to have some skilled people there who have experience working with folks who are ex-alcoholics, drug addicts, coming out of jail, and so forth. But I think you could do the whole thing. You know, you could start out doing it for like $500,000, and then maybe it'd cost $20,000 an inmate. But when you compare that to, you know, going to rehab, drug rehab for 4 months, I think it could be done really cheaply.
Right. Right, I do too. Well, I think the time is coming when we ought to consider crowdfunding. Anyway, so before we close, any other things you wanted to communicate about the ministry, or is there a way that people listening can contribute to the ministry now, just by sending a check to Christ Our Hope Church? The link's up on the blog.
Oh, they could. Yeah, we give. you know what we do, Catherine? We give these fellows really good Bibles. We buy Bibles from Ligonier Ministries, and they cost about $22 a piece. But I have to tell you, I had one of them come up to me and literally look me in the eye and say, I want you to know that Bible has changed my life.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're serious. And some of these fellows, nobody has ever seriously given them a gift in their whole lives. I know that sounds preposterous.
So if we all send a check for $25 to Christ Our Hope, we can buy one Bible.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, that'd be
okay,
wonderful.
Well, the links on that, ladies and gentlemen, the links on the blog, and you can link right to the church, get the address. And just as a matter of disclosure, obviously Franklin's the reverend and I'm a member of the congregation, so we have a conflict of interest because we think what we're doing is great. And since I'm not doing it with you, I think I can say, honestly, it's terrific. And, you know, it's so funny to watch Johnny Bain and all the folks who go over to the jailhouse ministry because they're so excited when they come back. They're always so revved up, you know, about the experience.
Yeah. Well, let me suggest one last thing, and that is to everybody who's listening to us, if you know somebody in jail, write them a letter.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
You have no idea what it means just to get a letter from outside and just to know that somebody's thinking about you and that you're not dead. And it doesn't, you know, maybe they're in jail because they did something bad. It doesn't mean when you try to relieve their suffering that you agree with what they did. It just means that you recognize that they're still a human being and you still care for them.
Right. So, that connection means a huge amount.
Right.
A huge amount. Okay, well, Franklin, as always, it's always a pleasure to have you on the Solari Report. I probably shouldn't mix up the issues. Anything you want to say about the market? Because, you know, you and I are we are multi-track minds, but we do tend to think about the market.
I think you've seen silver and gold. They're wheeling around, and they've done really well at the beginning of this year. And I think probably we saw a double bottom in December, but you've got to have proof. You know, you've got to have gains that
keep
coming.
I hope you're right, but I got to see proof.
Yeah, well, I'm the same way.
Okay, well, again, thank you very much. You have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for Jailhouse Ministry. Again, you have a wonderful day, too. Bye.